Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking that they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. The crime the couple committed was simple. They bought a house. I know it doesn't sound like a crime on the surface, but bear with me here. It made sense that they wanted a house. They had six kids, five of their own and a young relative, whom they wanted to keep safe in the neighborhood they were renting in. Wasn't that? They had saved the money for a down payment. That can be a tough feat, but this was in 1945 and the wartime economy, where both parents could work good jobs helping to build the Allied war machine, meant they could live off a single salary and bank the other. Finding the house they wanted in St. Louis should have been straightforward. They had the money, they had steady employment, they were a respectable family. But the house that they found, a modest two-story brick home at 4600 Labadie Avenue, came with a problem, a legally binding restriction recorded with a property deed back in 1911 that said certain people could not live there, not for another 16 years when the restriction would expire in 1961. J.D. and Ethel Shelley were among those certain people, not because of anything they'd done, not because they couldn't afford the house, but because they were Black. See, so many Black Americans had already migrated to St. Louis in the earlier part of the century seeking better jobs that the segregated Black neighborhoods were already bursting at the seams. Then the war had begun and more factory workers were needed at the massive St. Louis Ordnance Plant, which employed 35,000 of all races to manufacture ammunition for small arms and artillery. There was also the draw of the St. Louis Car Company, which built amphibious tractors for the Marines, vehicles that proved crucial in the Pacific Island hopping campaigns and river crossings in Europe. J.D. and Ethel Shelley had done the hard work, like millions of Americans, to win the war. And now they quite reasonably wanted to embrace fully the freedom they had helped preserve at home. The most desirable neighborhood for people of color in St. Louis was called The Ville, as described by one of the people who lived there in Jeffrey Copeland's book, Olivia's Story. The neighborhood was, quote, just a short streetcar ride from the main downtown district. The Ville's borders were clearly defined. Taylor Avenue on the west, Sarah Street on the east, St. Louis Avenue on the north, and Easton Avenue on the southern rim. There were invisible fences along each one of those streets that kept families both in and out of the area, if not literally, then symbolically, and we all knew it. End quote. Inside The Ville, Black families could own homes. Outside of it, they largely could not. When the Shelleys began house hunting, there was nothing available in The Ville. Attorney Brooke Gurley.
J.D. Shelley, he was on a wait list. He couldn't get in. He couldn't get into one of the homes. Again, because of the restrictive covenants, he was limited.
And that is when J.D. conspired to become a wanton criminal simply by signing his name. The legal battle that followed would make it all the way to the United States Supreme Court and result in one of the landmark civil rights case rulings of the 20th century. A crucial step on the road from Plessy v. Ferguson to Brown v. Board of Education. But that was all still to come. First, J.D. and Ethel just wanted to move their kids into a safer home. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Hims.
At some point, you stop blaming stress, sleep, or just getting older. If something's off in the bedroom, it's probably crossed your mind to actually do something about it.
Yeah, and a lot of people just don't.
Right. They put it off, even though ED is way more common than most guys think. And the reality now is getting help is a lot simpler than it used to be.
That's where Hims comes in.
Exactly. Hims connects you with licensed healthcare providers online so you can get access to legitimate ED treatment options without awkward appointments or standing in a pharmacy line.
Instead, you just complete a simple online intake, a provider reviews your information, and if treatment is right for you, it ships directly to your door in discreet packaging.
Yep, and that includes Sildenafil, the generic for Viagra, which is available through Hims at up to 95% less than the brand name version.
And if that's not the right fit, there are other treatment options available too, so you can find what actually works for your body.
To get simple online access to personalized affordable care for ED, hair loss, weight loss, and more, visit Hims.com/COTC. That's Hims.com/COTC for your free online visit.
Hims.com/COTC. Prescription required. See website for details and important safety information. Sildenafil is the generic version of Viagra. Viagra is a registered trademark of Viatris Specialty LLC. Hims is not affiliated with or endorsed by Viatris. J.D. Shelley and Ethel Lampkins got married on December 14, 1923. They were both about 16. That's awfully young, of course, but it wasn't unusual for the time where they lived, which was Mississippi. As far as history can tell, that was J.D.'s full and proper name, by the way, just the initials. I couldn't find his birth certificate, but every census document and city directory I could find never called him anything else. Now, J.D. was a hard worker, having done sawmill work and railroad construction when that paid well enough. J.D. and Ethel lived in Starkville, Mississippi, a mill town, which grew a bit with the 1878 founding there of Mississippi State University, a land-grant college. J.D. did a lot of construction work there. Ethel worked for a wealthy white family as in-home help until her own family began to grow and she wanted to spend more time with them. As a gesture of goodwill to her employers, she helped them find her replacement, a young teen named Opal Jean, though everyone called her Sister Hun. Not long after Sister Hun started, some of the homeowner's wife's jewelry went missing. The White family promptly accused the new girl of stealing it. She denied that, but was fired anyway. Walking home from church the next Sunday, the Shelleys saw the police come to Sister Hun's house and take her away. J.D. couldn't believe that her father had let them do that without creating a fuss. He figured the least he should have done was go with her. And if he had, maybe what happened to her next would have been avoided. As J.D. would later explain to Peter Irons for his book, The Courage of Their Convictions, quote, "So they take Sister Hun up there to the lady's house and they beat her. They beat that child with a hose and throwed her in a ditch. And my kids come from church and they saw her and they came running to the house and say, 'Dad, they done beat Sister Hun and she can't walk.'" End quote. A week later, the supposedly stolen jewelry was discovered, carefully tucked away on the white woman's bedstand. It had always been there. Later stories would claim that J.D. moved from Mississippi to Missouri because he was running from a lynch mob, but that's not the case. He left Mississippi because he had seen his children weren't safe there, not even in the town where he had grown up. He moved to Missouri ahead of the rest of the family. He found work making $17 a week in St. Louis, his rent was $12 a month, and stayed alone for a year before he felt he could bring his family west. Priscilla Dowden White, associate professor of history at the University of Missouri-St. Louis, explained to St. Louis Public TV's Carol Daniel what the city looked like to those who migrated there.
It was the cultural scene here, too, that was attracting African-American migrants as well. And when I say culture, I'm not just talking about the arts, although mm-hmm. that was a part of it, the music, but it was the social life, where African Americans are able to socialize and move mm-hmm, about mm-hmm. more freely
right.
than they have been in the South and even in some other urban
right.
areas.
From his own limited remarks, we know J.D. found the city inexpensive, if still mostly off limits to anyone not white. Among the places he lamented his family and neighbors weren't welcomed were both the famed Fox Theater and Sportsman's Park, where the St. Louis Cardinals played. But the Shelleys were determined to stay. They found a house to rent on North 9th Street in a part of the Ville that the family found crowded, noisy, and scary at night because of the presence of nearby clubs and bars. It wasn't an ideal situation. It irritated J.D. that he couldn't get his landlord to fix even the smallest things. Once, when he fixed the pipes in his kitchen, his landlord found out what he had done and upped the rent because of the renovation. The Shelleys felt stuck, and really, they were, because they couldn't move just anywhere in the city, not even if they had the money to do so. That's because white property owners across St. Louis had been attaching racially restrictive covenants to their property deeds, prohibiting the sale of homes to Black families. These covenants had been around for years, some possibly as early as the 1850s. They had always stood up against legal challenges. In 1916, St. Louis voters tried to go even further, passing a segregation ordinance that would have used the force of the law to mandate where Black residents could live. Legislators had done similar things in other cities, but St. Louis voters were the first to approve such a measure by popular vote. That ordinance was struck down by the courts in 1917. The court said the government couldn't mandate racial segregation in housing. So the real estate industry doubled down on private restrictive covenants instead, agreements they believed would be immune from constitutional challenge since they were contracts between private parties, not government mandates. Then, in the mid-1920s, the very white St. Louis Real Estate Exchange started systematizing the whole thing, essentially deciding who could live where. The area had just witnessed the 1917 riots in East St. Louis, where white industrial workers murdered Black workers for allegedly taking their jobs. The exchange thought they might placate white workers by making it official policy. They would not sell or rent homes to Black families outside the Ville. From that point on, the exchange made sure that whenever they sold a house, they attached a Caucasian-only restrictive covenant to the property deed. The wording varied, with some covenants specifying that new owners could not have more than 1/32nd of the blood in their veins belonging to another racial group. The covenants tried to cover all possible ways around the restrictions, though they didn't wish to prohibit white owners from having Black service workers live there in lesser accommodations. Here's how a typical covenant read. Quote, "Be it known, no part of said premises shall in any matter be owned or used or occupied directly or indirectly by anyone Black, provided that this restriction shall not prevent the occupation during the period of their employment as janitors or chauffeurs of quarters in the basement or in a barn or a garage in the rear or other servants' quarters by said employee when in the service of the rightful owner or occupant of said premises," end quote. By the time the University of Iowa studied St. Louis's home records in 2018, looking at the period between 1850 and 1950, they found nearly 800 unique racially restrictive covenants that were tied to 30,000 pieces of property in the city. According to Dowden White,
from 1910 to 1948, for example, in St. Louis, there were close to 350 individual covenant agreements that are established. And so that helps us to understand how segregation is structurally
is entrenched.
There were neighborhoods just across the street from the Ville where Black residents occasionally could rent homes, thus living side by side with whites. This was frowned upon by the exchange, but not forbidden, likely because somewhere in the recent past, white property owners had already attached covenants to those parcels, prohibiting permanent sale to Black families, even if rental was technically possible. The proliferation of racial covenants everywhere coincided with the rise of the real estate industry in the United States. Developers were busy building subdivisions and shopping centers, using these covenants as a way to ensure the distance between white and African American populations. And while the little real estate that St. Louis had yielded to its black residents was close to the city center, it wasn't growing fast enough to keep pace with the growing population. Housing grew tighter by the day. Friction between homeowners, more and more dicey. Gwen Moore, exhibit curator at the Missouri History Museum, explains.
They often talked about blacks moving into white neighborhoods as an invasion. There was always this fear of blacks living in close proximity to whites.
Still, it raised the question, where were all these new people supposed to live? The number of African Americans who flooded into St. Louis during World War II was so significant that it became known as the Second Great Migration. Nationwide, 1.5 million Black Southerners moved north and west during the early to mid-1940s. The Black population in St. Louis increased by 41%. Meanwhile, the street-by-street covenant process was de facto reinforced by governmental and financial institutions. Here's the host of City Rising, a production of PBS SoCal, explaining how that worked.
Look at the Homeowners Loan Corporation maps, the redlining maps. The federal government basically would divide up cities and communities into various different strata, like cuts of beef. And they would have green areas, which were very desirable and highly investable, blue areas, also desirable and highly investable. Then they had yellow areas that are slightly higher risk, so be careful. And then they had red zones. In those red areas, they basically wouldn't back mortgages or insurance policies.
You probably know this as redlining, and it, in so many ways, has led us to where we are even today. Gilda Haas, an activist who has taught community economic development courses at UCLA for 3 decades, explains the ramifications.
This is something that happened all over our country. There are people who never got to pass on homes to their children. There were people who never got to build up credit. There were entire neighborhoods that were deprived of investment opportunities. And so when you're talking about institutionalized racism, those are the institutions that manufacture relationships and opportunities in a city.
JD probably didn't know all that. He just wanted a house in a nice neighborhood that was big enough for his family. Then, one day near the end of the war, one of his sons told him about how he had had to rescue one of his sisters. She'd been walking home from school and had come close to being roughed up. That was the last straw. JD found a house for sale at 4600 Labadie Avenue on a street just blocks from the Ville. The brick house was built in 1906. It had 1,760 square feet of living space and one bath. The Shelley's realtor had researched it and found that the property deed to the house included a racially restrictive covenant that dated back to 1911. Its wording in the Shelley's case included the following, quote, "Future sale will not be made to persons not of Caucasian race for a period of 50 years from the date of undersignment of title," end quote. That meant it would not be legal for J.D. and Ethel to buy the property until 1961, and who knew if the restriction would truly be lifted then anyway. And the Shelleys loved the house. The purchase price was $5,700. J.D. had a down payment and some friends. Before I tell you about the conspiracy, which has been well documented by various legal, historical, and journalistic sources, I need to be transparent about one nagging question that didn't clear itself up even with a good bit of research. And that is, what did JD know and when did he know it? That is, was he an innocent bystander used by more schooled and ambitious others? Or did he know from the beginning that buying this house would cause a ruckus? That it was, in fact, meant to. Now, you'll note I didn't include Ethel here because all sources tend to agree that Ethel was completely unaware of any attempt to subvert the law. If JD did know in advance, he might have left her in the dark because he knew she was just too honest. I know that because her later testimony in the case makes that aspect of her personality abundantly clear. In the retelling of the story to Irons, the chronicler of his story, JD seems willing to simplify the how of what happened. He says he bought the house first, unaware that there was anything amiss, and was shocked by what happened after. I suspect that's nice fiction. It's kind of how, like, most of us grew up believing Rosa Parks was just too tired on that early December day in 1955 to go to the back of the bus, thus inadvertently sparking the 381-day Montgomery bus boycott and all that came after that. Spoiler alert, Miss Parks' C choice that day was a premeditated act of civil disobedience planned by mostly Black women civil rights activists aimed at ending segregation, not just on the Montgomery bus lines, but in all its forms. Rosa was no pawn. But some do believe that J.D. stumbled blindly into his courageous stand against the racial covenants of St. Louis. It's hard to know for certain, as he tends to skirt the details in the one account we have from his point of view, but I mean, he would have had to have known, right? It would have been immoral for him to have been left in the dark, and the people surrounding him who would have had to have done that were not immoral in any sense. But I'm getting ahead of myself. All of this is to say that for the sake of clarity in telling this story, I'm going to take JD's word for it as I unfold things, but I've made my reservations known. So here we go. The Reverend Robert Bishop, Ethel Shelley's pastor at the Church of God in Christ, was the first to gather the group of conspirators together. To supplement his meager pastoral salary, Reverend Bishop dabbled in real estate. Ethel had told him of the family's desire to buy a bigger, safer home. He had gotten in touch with James Bush, a highly respected Black realtor who owned several apartment buildings and often helped arrange loans for those wanting to purchase within the Ville. In turn, the two men found Josephine Fitzgerald, a 40-something-year-old white woman who was more than happy to act as a straw buyer for the property. That is, she would buy the home on Labadee and then transfer the title to the Shelleys. Because there were a few Black families who rented in the area, it was hoped that no one would question the ownership of the home. Now, to be clear, it was the transfer to the Shelleys that would be illegal. That would have to be as carefully orchestrated as a jewel heist. The Reverend and the realtor also needed someone to lose the covenant in a surreptitious rewriting of the deed. For that, they roped in Olivia Meriwether Perkins, a Black science teacher at the nearby well-regarded and segregated Sumner High School. Years later, Olivia would share all of these details with Arthur Copeland. The assembled bunch worked out the details and assured J.D. that whatever costs he incurred should the truth be found out would be handled by Bush, by the Black attorneys in town, and, failing that, by Bishop's church. On the day of the transfer of sale to J.D., he was not to be present at the full-service bank they had chosen. Miss Fitzgerald was a notary who would certify that, though he had unfortunately taken ill, he had signed the papers in front of her and she had notarized them, per legal requirement. Miss Fitzgerald bought the property and held it for a few days. Then, one late Friday afternoon in August of 1945, she walked into the bank and engaged the youngest and most inexperienced clerk there. She wore a low-cut dress to make sure he was distracted from the work at hand. Miss Perkins was already at the bank, having made an appointment with the bank manager, someone she knew as they shared an interest in photography. As a goodwill gesture in the Black community he served, he had even helped her set up a photo club at Sumner. Miss Perkins was there to distract him. As it was almost quitting time, she was in his office, already having him look over some photos she had taken at a recent flower show held at Forest Park. It had been a whites-only show, but she had managed to get in as the host believed she was with the catering and cleaning crews. Anyway, the plan worked reasonably well, with a few minor adjustments to the script. In Olivia's story, author Copeland wrote that because of the timely and unexpected entrance of white Major League Baseball player Vern Stevens, he played for the other Major League team in town, the St. Louis Browns, bank personnel rushed through whatever they were doing so they could get an autograph. This wasn't a coincidence. It had apparently been a last-minute addition to the plan made by the good reverend, who happened to know Stevens, who knew nothing about the larger scheme but agreed to show up at the bank when the minister asked. Suffice to say, the transfer papers got signed by the bank manager, who was barely paying attention to what he was signing. Then Miss Perkins and Miss Fitzgerald walked out of the bank and waited for the next shoe to drop. The Shelleys' move from 9th Street to Labadie Avenue was to be handled by a white moving crew to keep interest down. Now that night, when J.D. got off the bus just two blocks from his new home, two police officers followed him there and made sure he had a key to the house before they let him be. A few days later, around 7 p.m., J.D. said a man came to the door to serve him a summons to appear in court. When the man refused to tell him what the matter concerned, J.D. refused to take the papers. Thus, he could claim that he had not been served and did not, under law, have to appear. But it appeared the jig was up. The Reverend Bishop contacted George Vaughn, a local influential black attorney who was a founding member of the Mound City Bar Association, a group that assisted black lawyers, and a longtime committee member of the local NAACP. He also was the son of people who'd been enslaved. Incidentally, earlier that year, the NAACP's network of black attorneys had convened a series of conferences to discuss the covenant issue and had worked on a strategy to defeat them. One of the lawyers there suggested that they find themselves some test cases. Wouldn't you know it, the lawyer with that bright idea had been George Vaughn. Vaughn soon learned that the Shelleys were being sued by their neighbors, Lewis and Fern Kramer, for violation of the neighborhood covenant. The Kramers wanted the Circuit Court of St. Louis to evict the Shelleys immediately. The couple claimed to have a vested interest in having them gone, not just because they lived close by and preferred to live among white people, but also because Fern's parents had been among the original 39 homeowners who signed the joint covenant years earlier. The Kramers were backed by the Marcus Avenue Improvement Association, the originators of the restrictive clause. The case was assigned to no-nonsense judge William K. Kerner. A quick note, the timeline here is a tad mushy. I found one October 10th, 1945 story in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch that indicates that Judge Kerner had just the day before issued a temporary restraining order to stop the Shelleys from moving into the house. All other narratives indicate that they had already done so. I'm not sure which is right. In the October 26, 1945 edition of the St. Louis Argus, the black-owned newspaper, it was reported that Kerner's injunction was denied. In any case, the courtroom showdown was to begin November 1st. When it did, it was packed. One side was filled with white onlookers, the other side with black. Gerald Seegers, speaking for the Kramers, began by saying that covenants were nothing new in St. Louis, and his clients, quote, are owed a protection of their rights in this great city of St. Louis, nothing more, end quote. George Vaughn, speaking for the Shelleys, invoked both the 13th and 14th Amendments to the Constitution. The 13th, of course, abolished slavery. The 14th guarantees equal protection under the law. Seegers objected, and the objection was sustained. But the record would show Vaughn tried. Seegers later countered the equal protection argument by saying that the state could and should enforce the same racial restrictions when and if there were a no whites clause in black neighborhoods. That was a mighty big if. You could park a semi under that if. Vaughn ignored that. He took pains to argue that the covenants violated the Federal Civil Rights Act of 1866, the Reconstruction Era attempt to extend to newly emancipated black people the same right to buy and sell property as enjoyed by their white brethren. The Homeowners Association representative took exception to that, testifying, quote, we're not trying to deny anyone their liberties. We just prefer to live separately, which is our right under the law, end quote. Seegers came off angry that he was having to debate this at all. Vaughn was measured and careful. He established that not everyone in the original neighborhood had signed the covenant. He established that the Shelleys had a right to the American dream. He also made sure that the court understood that this transaction had happened between a willing buyer and a willing seller. Then Miss Kramer took the stand. As expected, she reasserted her right to not have anyone black live next to her. Vaughn was ready. He responded, quote, "You're right. Let me get this straight. You said that it is your right, under the law, to decide all by yourself where the Shelleys can live? Is that correct?" End quote. He went on to establish that black families, he named them one by one, had previously owned property on her street. One was a Mrs. Grace Boxley, who had been willed the property by the people she worked for in 1882, and that her family had lived there ever since, and that property values hadn't dropped per her attorney's argument. And Vaughn continued that Mrs. Kramer knew deep inside that what she was arguing was wrong. When Mrs. Fitzgerald was called to testify, she explained that she had never been asked to sign any covenant when she bought the property. She was asked about any restrictions she was aware of. She answered that she knew she couldn't keep livestock there. Seegers responded by calling Miss Fitzgerald a straw buyer. She seemed not to agree. When Ethel Shelley was called to the stand, she would not swear to tell the truth, which caused a bit of an uproar. Asked why, by the judge, she said her religious beliefs made it a sin to swear. He asked if she could instead promise to do so. She was okay with that. When Vaughn stood up to question her, he asked why she wanted to live with white people. She said she didn't. More gasping. Vaughn urged her to continue. She said, quote, "In the eyes of the Lord, we're all his children, all of us. I think it's wrong to judge a person by their color. I was brought up to believe it's what's in here, in the heart, that matters most of all. So when I say I don't want to live with white people, I mean I don't care what color they are. And I pray that someday, at least for the sake of my people, others will not notice the color of my skin first when they meet me," end quote. Seegers, on cross-examination, asked if she had knowingly flouted the covenant attached to the property on Labadee. She responded that she had not. When they had first seen the house, she said she had also seen black and white children playing together in the street. Quote, "I was thinking that children are pretty smart, that most don't yet see colors. Who makes them see colors, Mr. Seegers? Can you answer that for me? Who makes them see colors?" Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by ads. You heard me. We are sponsored by ads. I feel like I should clarify that because every now and then we get a review that's like, wow, that's a lot of ads.
I'm sorry. Are we supposed to be doing this for free?
Apparently. News to me.
I would also like free groceries.
And in this economy, how about some free gas? Am I right? Like, I don't get healthcare making podcasts, people. This is the job.
And for the record, the ad to content ratio here? Very reasonable.
Extremely. Go watch literally any TV show or listen to commercial radio and then come back to me.
We'll wait.
I at least try to make these like little oases in the midst of these sometimes pretty rough stories. That's why I do them with you, Scott. You make them more fun for me.
Oh, shucks.
But all that said, if our ads really drive you nuts, we do have options. You can subscribe at grabbackcollab.com and get early ad-free episodes of Crimes of the Centuries, plus a bonus episode with every main episode.
Which is actually a really good deal.
It is! Or, if that feels like too much effort, you can subscribe right through Apple Podcasts. That gets you ad-free episodes and bonuses. Not early, but still ad-free.
So you've got choices. Keep the ads and support the show that way, or skip the ads and support the show that way.
Either way,
we eat.
Which we are very fond of.
Big fans.
So thank you, ads, for sponsoring our episodes. 2 days after closing arguments, Judge Kerner called everyone back to hear his verdict. He first noted that real estate covenants were legal and weren't in violation of the Constitution of Missouri. Next, he said no one had shown him any documents that said the property at 4600 Labadee had such a covenant or that anyone had signed such a thing. Now remember, the covenant had been carefully lost in the rewriting by Mrs. Perkins, according to Copeland's book. Lastly, Kerner said, even the property association agreed that not everyone in the neighborhood had signed the racially restrictive covenant, not even all the way back in 1911. He then pronounced his verdict. The Kramer's case had no merit. He ordered them to pay court costs of $701.01. The Kramers were angry enough now to appeal to the Supreme Court of Missouri, which, in December 1946, reversed Kerner's judgment, ordering the lower court to grant relief to the Kramers and, thus, effectively evict the Shelleys from their home. That ruling determined no one had violated the Shelleys' constitutionally guaranteed rights. Black Americans, fresh off having served in the war for freedom from tyranny, were not ready to see it end there. By now, not only had the original consortium of St. Louis's black attorneys and ministers raised funds to fight these restrictions, but black notables such as baseball's Jackie Robinson had given money to help matters proceed. Then NAACP, led by Thurgood Marshall, the attorney who was becoming known for his courage and his ability to convince courts to live up to the Constitution they swore by, called a second conference on racial covenants in January 1947. They had hope. A month earlier, President Harry Truman had impaneled a special 15-person commission on civil rights, and high on their list was racial covenants. Missouri, if you recall, was Truman's home state. In April 1947, Vaughn and his battalion of lawyers asked the Supreme Court to take on the Shelley case. It had something other potential test cases didn't, a sociological argument. They would argue, in addition to the constitutional mandates, that overcrowded slum conditions had detrimental effects on the victims of such covenants, making them helpless to overcome their circumstances, no matter how hard they worked. In short, they would put the American dream on trial. In October 1947, in a surprise move, the U.S. government made it known it would write an amicus brief supporting the Shelleys. The government's position was that segregation harmed the country's international standing and was quite damaging to its long-term health at home. The United States Supreme Court accepted the case, which it heard in late 1947. By then, a few similar cases from other jurisdictions had been rolled in beneath the umbrella of the Shelley v. Kramer case, so it included homeowners-to-be from Michigan and Washington, D.C. as well. One such case was represented by attorneys Marshall and a young man named Lauren Miller. George Vaughn was still representing the Shelleys, but Miller and Marshall handled many of the briefs and arguments. Miller had great credentials, having won a 1945 ruling in favor of black residents in Los Angeles when he fought against racial covenants on behalf of Oscar winner Hattie McDaniel, whose turn in Mammy and Gone with the Wind was the first Academy Award won by a person of color. Miller had won that, but appeals left the case in limbo. If J.D., a St. Louis laborer, won in the highest court in the land, McDaniel's case would be decided once and for all. On the day it was argued, only six of the nine justices were in attendance. Three abstained, without comment on why, though scholars would later suggest that they likely owned property that carried such restrictions. Addressing the court was a veritable powerhouse of civil rights advocates. Black attorney George Vaughn and his white co-counsel Herman Willer, both of St. Louis, representing the Shelleys. Black attorneys Thurgood Marshall and Lauren Miller, representing other homeowners. And Philip Perlman, the white Solicitor General of the United States, arguing on behalf of the federal government. Perlman told the justices that the restrictive agreements on residential property, quote, should be relegated to the limbo of other things as dead as slavery, end quote. His 23-page argument took a full hour to deliver. Here's a taste. Quote, the Caucasians are under a heavy debt to colored Americans, We brought them here as slaves, as chattels devoid of human rights, privileges, and immunities. We set them free, promising them, in our amended Constitution and new laws, equal rights and privileges with all other people. Yet after three quarters of a century, attempts are made, by devices such as restrictive covenants, to hold them in bondage, to segregate them, to hem them in so that they cannot escape from the evil conditions under which so many of them are compelled to live. End quote. It seems it was a persuasive argument. Here's Cicely Hunter, public historian for the African American Initiative for the Missouri Historical Society, explaining how well that went.
And then finally, on May 3rd, 1948, it was determined that the restrictive covenant could not be judicially enforced, even though it was considered to be a private contract, because it was in violation of the 14th Amendment.
The court acknowledged that it was breaking new ground. The opinion included these words, quote, "Whether the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment inhibits judicial enforcement by state court of restrictive covenants based on race or color is a question which this court has never heretofore been called to consider," end quote. Then, writing for the unanimous majority, Truman appointee Justice Fred Vinson added that, quote, "It cannot be doubted that among the civil rights intended to be protected from the discriminatory state action by the 14th Amendment are the rights to acquire, enjoy, own, and dispose of property," end quote. The opinion continues on for pages, but I'll cut to the chase. While the covenants, in and of themselves, weren't illegal, judicial or state enforcement of such contracts was. On Friday, May 7, 1948, the St. Louis Argus ran a bold, over-the-fold headline, "Restrictive Covenants Unenforceable." Even bolder was the story's subhead, "Democracy Strengthened by Supreme Court's Decision." Not everyone was happy, as I'm sure you assumed. Here's a graph from a story that ran in the Baltimore newspaper called Afro-American. Quote, "Colored owners and prospective property owners are still rejoicing over the decision, while many whites are expressing bitter resentment," end quote. One of the whites who lost their case was already planning to move out of their home. But hey, Eleanor Roosevelt applauded the ruling. In a piece she wrote for Scripps Howard Papers, she called the covenants fundamentally unchristian and praised the court's decision as momentous and, quote, "a big step forward in assuring democratic rights in this country," end quote. The NAACP knew they had won a substantial victory. They also knew that change was slow and plodding. On the floor of the U.S. House of Representatives, John Rankin of Mississippi said there must have been a celebration in Moscow when the decision was handed down, because, you know, it was a commie move. The Shelleys couldn't sleep that night. It wasn't just their nerves. They kept being interrupted by phone calls from all over the nation, even the world, congratulating them and, in the case of media phone calls, asking for comment. They remained the couple who had married young and tried to do the best by their children. J.D. said only, quote, "It was a good thing we done this case," end quote. Ethel was Ethel. She was quoted as saying, "My little soul is overjoyed. Wait till I get by myself. I'll tell the Lord of my thankfulness." Things, they were a-changing. On July 26, 1948, President Truman signed Executive Order 9980, which mandated fair employment practices in the federal government and prohibited discrimination based on race, color, religion, or national origin in that sphere as well. That was followed by Executive Order 9981, which mandated equal treatment and opportunity for anyone in the U.S. Armed Forces, regardless of their race. Earlier that summer, he had already signed the Women's Armed Services Integration Act, granting women the right to serve as permanent members of every branch of the U.S. military. There were restrictions, yes, no combat, for example, but this was a big step. At the Democratic National Convention that same summer, then-Minneapolis Mayor Hubert Humphrey asked the assembled to adopt a strong civil rights platform. He urged the party to get out of the shadow of states' rights and walk forthrightly into the bright sunshine of human rights. That's a direct quote. Though a close vote, the convention adopted the civil rights language and made it part of the party platform. That prompted some Southern delegates to break away and form the States' Rights Party. You might know them as the Dixiecrats, who then nominated South Carolina Senator Strom Thurmond as president. He didn't win. Post-Franklin Roosevelt, black voters were an unknown quantity. But in the final days before the election that fall, Truman visited Harlem, the first president to ever do so. He was well-received. Soon after, in one of the greatest election upsets in American history, Truman defeated Thomas Dewey that November. In Harlem, that election day, he tallied 90,000 votes. Dewey, who was governor of New York, tallied only 25,000. Now, the Shelley decision had no immediate, thunderous effect. And sure, the case plaintiffs could live in relative peace, something they had intended to do all along, and a smattering of pending cases were finally settled thanks to the precedent set. Hattie McDaniel's case in Los Angeles was one of them. She and dozens of other black homeowners in the city's Sugar Hill neighborhood had been fighting their own covenant battle since 1945. They had won in California courts, but white homeowners had appealed. Shelley settled it for good. McDaniel and her neighbors could stay. But racial covenants hadn't been outlawed by the Supreme Court decision. They had just been made unenforceable. As University of Iowa history professor Colin Gordon told St. Louis Public Radio in 2018, after his study on the covenants had been published, quote, after Shelley v. Kramer, no one goes through and stamps unenforceable on every covenant. They just sit there, end quote. And white homeowners, real estate agents, banks, and local governments found plenty of ways to keep segregation alive. The covenants themselves stayed in property deeds, sometimes copied from old documents to new ones, sometimes just sitting there as a signal about who was welcome and who wasn't. Real estate agents practiced steering, showing black buyers homes only in certain neighborhoods while directing white buyers away from areas where black families lived. Banks continued redlining, refusing to insure mortgages in black neighborhoods or for black buyers trying to move into white areas. The FHA kept recommending these practices well into the 1960s. And when black families did manage to buy homes in white neighborhoods, they often faced harassment, threats, vandalism, even violence. White residents formed homeowners associations with the express purpose of keeping their neighborhoods segregated through intimidation and social pressure. Still, Shelley v. Kramer was a large and critical addition to the snowballing of civil rights victories, many determined by judicial interpretation of the Equal Protection Clause. The first had been 1944's Smith v. Allwright, also argued by Thurgood Marshall, a case involving the state of Texas and the Democratic Party's choice to hold all-white primaries. But the 1948 Shelley victory gave the civil rights movement proof that the courts could deliver justice. It emboldened lawyers and activists nationwide to pursue more test cases, using litigation as a powerful tool alongside public protest. It was about that time that George Vaughn was appointed Assistant Attorney General for the state of Missouri and served in that capacity until his death in 1949. Many of those who argued Shelley, Miller and Marshall specifically, argued and won the landmark 1954 decision in Brown v. Board of Education that desegregated America's schools. The separate but equal fiction created by the 1896 decision rendered in Plessy v. Ferguson was crumbling fast. Shelley v. Kramer has been cited countless times in conjunction with civil rights cases over the last 78 years, as it's now considered a cornerstone case in American jurisprudence. One of the more significant cases where its reasoning held was 1991's Edmondson v. Leesville Concrete Company. In that case, the justices ruled that the use of peremptory challenges based on race, those meant to exclude jurors from serving in a particular trial, was unconstitutional, even in civil cases. Their rationale was strikingly similar to the one used in Shelley. That is, because the government is involved in selecting jurors, and while it ostensibly has no stake in what happens in a civil case, it requires all parties to behave in accordance with the Equal Protection Clause. So, the case lives on. Again, here's Brooke Gurley, an assistant professor of law at Widener University Delaware Law School, explaining the impact.
Well, it's important because of what the Shelleys did, as well as Mr. Bush and his conspiracy of heroes, we are able to live wherever we want to, so long as we can afford it. And while, yes, I don't deny that there's still a racial caste system within our communities, but as far as that being allowed legally, you know, de jure segregation in that way is no longer permitted.
Thurgood Marshall was appointed to the Supreme Court in 1967 by President Lyndon Johnson, becoming the first Black justice in the nation's history. The year after that, in 1968, racial covenants were finally officially outlawed with the passage of the Fair Housing Act. By that time, the Shelleys had moved from 4600 Labadie, where they had lived for a decade. They hopped over to St. Louis Avenue, a few blocks away, mostly because they needed more room. J.D. rented the house for 2 years and then sold it for $9,500. In late 1990, the house was designated a National Historic Landmark, recognizing its unassuming role in American history. Ethel died before J.D. in 1984. They had been together 60 years. When J.D. died in 1997, he left behind 24 grandchildren, 66 great-grandchildren, and 32 great-great-grandchildren. He was 91. To research this case, journalist Amy Wilson read Olivia's story, The Conspiracy of Heroes Behind Shelley v. Kramer, and Peter Iron's The Courage of Their Convictions. She consulted legal websites to track down the facts as they were presented to the courts. She also watched a terrific documentary on Thurgood Marshall. Her in-laws live in St. Louis. Next time she's there, she says she's going to find this house and pay her respects. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grabbag Collab. Head to www.grabbagcollab.com for exclusive content related to this show and access to other series on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this case was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Henry Lavoie. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and sometimes my child, Hunt Van Benskoten. Other music comes from Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, please help us out by rating and reviewing on Apple Podcasts. Also, tell your friends. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com. On Instagram, we're @centuriespod, and you can find us on the Crimes of the Centuries Facebook page.